My first guest is a broadcast legend. His name is Don Hewitt. You know that name because he has been behind the TV show 60 Minutes for about three decades or so. He also has now written a book called Tell Me a Story, 50 Years and 60 Minutes on Television. It is the book of the week on my website, harrisonline.com, and I'm happy to welcome him to the show from, I'm guessing, the 60 Minute headquarters in New York. Hello, Don.
You guessed right. That's exactly where I am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let me start you with an easy question here.
Yep.
Who is Shahib Shahab, or Shahab Shahib?
Ed Bradley once played a practical joke on me and sent out a memo that said he wanted to be known from now on by his African name, Shahib Shahab, and I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. And when I saw the memo, all I could think was, oh, my God, I'm Mike Wallace, I'm Wally Safer, I'm Andy Rooney, I'm Shahib Shahab. But it was Ed's wonderful sense of humor.
Did he go as far as sending a memo to the personnel people saying, please, from now on, my paycheck should be made out to?
Yeah, he did, but it never went anywhere. It was a phony, but I fell for it.
That's great. That's great. Let's talk a little bit about what you did on 60 Minutes this weekend.
Yes.
Which was the McVeigh show that that Mr. Shahib Shahab did a few years ago, the one-on-one with him. And, of course, this was a follow-up talking to some of the families because McVeigh was supposed to be executed tomorrow and now won't be. When you have something like that and it's a 60 Minutes exclusive, do you look at that and say, okay, so we've got this, but it's such a huge story now, a couple of years later after we've done the interview, everybody has played it up so much, we're not going to go back there. We don't want to do what everybody else has done before.
Ha ha ha. You put your finger on it. If anybody else had an interview with McVeigh or had ever gotten into that death row cell, I don't think we would have done it. We were the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said in the promo, while everybody is talking about Timothy McVeigh, Ed Bradley is talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what you've got is you've got the whole world talking about a guy, and Ed Bradley's the only one who's ever talked to him.
Do you think from now having seen that interview a couple of times, because I'm sure you watched it again in preparing Sunday's show, did we learn anything from Bradley talking to McVeigh?
Sure. You got a characterization of a strange guy who is kind of spooky. And, what you get is a character sketch. And you don't necessarily always get the answers to the questions you want to ask, which are, you know, who was in it with you? How long did it take you to program and plan it? Of course we'd love to have that. But I thought it was a great character sketch of a guy who will be in the history books forever as the biggest terrorist mass murderer in the history of this country.
Would you air his execution if it were your choice?
No, let me tell you. I know I wouldn't because I don't think anybody gives a damn and wants to watch it. But let me tell you something about executions. No, I would not show a guy in front of a firing squad. I would not show somebody in being fried in an electric chair. I would not show somebody on a gallows. When a guy lies on a gurney and a guy puts a hypodermic needle in him and he goes to sleep and he doesn't wake up, my God, that happens every week on ER.
Yeah.
It's anticlimactic. What is it? What are you looking at?
Mm-hmm. Do you think any network should be allowed to show it?
It's allowed is I think anybody should be allowed to do anything. I mean, I'm against all these rules, but I would hope nobody would decide that that was good entertainment. We did once show Jack Kevorkian putting a terminal patient out of his misery. And people were shocked that we showed that moment. And I said, wait a minute. If the moment that this guy left all his earthly cares, his troubles and his travail, and floated up to heaven in the arms of God to live with the angels forever after, if that ain't what it was, what are these guys talking to me about at all these funerals they go to? Because they keep telling me that.
Mm-hmm.
So what was so terrible about that?
I thought it was terrific television. And I'm one of the few people who will say publicly, if the execution were broadcast, I'd have to watch it. There'd be no way I couldn't watch it.
Well, you're probably right. You know, it's like watching an accident.
Yeah.
You know, you can't take your eyes off a car accident. That's why half the traffic in America slows down because people are, you know, they're watching.
Yep.
They're, what do they call it?
Rubbernecking.
Rubbernecking.
Yeah.
Sure. And it's more of the same to watch somebody be killed. It's rubbernecking.
The other thing I was thinking as I was watching Ed Bradley do the interview with McVeigh, or you re-aired the interview with McVeigh,
right,
is I always wonder when, since I've never been in that situation, to sit down face-to-face with somebody like that,
yeah,
I wonder how much of that doesn't come through the television camera. You know, when you talk to Bradley afterwards, I don't know if you were there for that interview, but when you talk to him afterwards, does he tell you it was creepy in there or this guy is this
no,
way?
No, he said it on the air. He said, you know, there were moments when I thought, hey, this is like typical American boy. And then I thought, oh, my God, no, this guy is a cold-blooded killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this guy smiles a lot. He talks about, you know, what he dreamed about when he was a kid and having a Lamborghini and a bunch of girlfriends. And you begin to think, you know, this is the kid next door. And then you think of, God forbid, this guy lives next door to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Or drives his truck near where I live.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What's happening? It's Tuesday of the week now. What's happening in the 60 Minutes world to prepare for next Sunday's broadcast? What are you doing today?
Okay, I'm working on a story with a wonderful gal named Carol Marine, who used to work in Chicago, was doing some stuff for us on I'll tell you what the I'll read you the rating.
Okay.
All right? What we're going to say is, as if the FBI doesn't have enough on its hands trying to explain its mishandling of evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing case, the agency is also under fire for declaring as a suicide what several senators believe was the murder of an American priest in Kenya. The priest's family is convinced that the African dictator who runs that country had a hand in his death, and the FBI is involved in a cover-up. An American priest from Minnesota was, as far as we can see, and as far as his family can see, and several senators can see, was murdered in Kenya because he was helping villagers resist a lot of ethnic cleansing by the man who runs Kenya,
mm-hmm,
and one day was found murdered. And the FBI came in, because he's an American citizen, and said it was a suicide. Well, there are several senators who do not believe that for 1 second, and you got to wonder whether there's a cover-up, because the dictator who runs Kenya is a guy you don't want to ruffle his feathers, because that's the place where our embassy was blown up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you got wheels within wheels.
How does that become a 60-minute story? Or how does anything become a 60-minute story?
Good reporters hear about stories like that and go to Kenya and poke around and talk to members of the government and talk to members of the opposition and come back with a story.
Do they have to pitch you first? Does somebody come
yep.
in to you? Hello, Mr. Hewitt, I have an idea for a great story that we can do.
Yep, that's kind of what I do.
Yeah.
And I sign off on all the stories, and they go do them, and they're none better than the people who work here.
What is not a 60-minute story?
Rude, lascivious. I stayed away from the O.J. Simpson story only because we had nothing to add to it every week, every Sunday, and I didn't want to look at that crazy kid, you know, I forget his name.
Cato Kalin?
Cato Kalin, one more time, or I want to talk to limo driver one more time.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a perfect example. The JonBenet story.
Mm-hmm.
That story has not moved one inch from the day it was first reported.
Mm-hmm.
No reporter has been able to come up with anything. And they keep playing it and playing it and playing it because, you know, the young beauty queen, affluent family. There's no story there, and they keep making a story out of nothing.
Mm-hmm. And yet there are stories that have been completely blown out of proportion, and 60 Minutes has opted to be a part of them. The Princess Di story and the John story.
No, we did Princess Di one day. We didn't stay with that story over and over and over again. I was quoted the other day as the kind of stories that I think get overplayed. I thought the death of the tragic plane accident that killed John Kennedy was, you know, a terrible, tragic, awful story, and we all felt just terrible about it. But come on, God didn't die that day. And I thought that was overplayed.
Mm-hmm.
As tragic as it was and as mournful as it wasn't worth all that coverage.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I agree and said so on the show.
Good.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Don Hewitt. The book is called Tell Me a Story, 50 Years and 60 Minutes in Television. Let's go back to the pre-60 Minutes years. You directed the Nixon-Kennedy debate in 1960. Was that
I
your
did.
Job?
I produced and directed that show.
Now, there's a picture of you in the book with both presidential candidates at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that as the director, you have to talk to these guys ahead of time and tell them, here's what we're going to do, because this was the first time.
Right.
What did you tell them?
Well, I met with Kennedy in a hangar at Midway Airport in Chicago a week before the debate. And, you know, he was curious, well, where do I stand, where do I look, how many questions, how much time do I have to answer. He was vitally interested. I never saw Richard Nixon until he showed up there that night.
Hmm.
Nixon thought it was just another campaign appearance and didn't realize that an election could rise or fall on that one appearance, and it did. And the people who heard it on radio thought Nixon won. The people who watched it on television thought Kennedy won, only because they'd never seen a guy like that before. This guy looked like a Harvard undergrad, Ivy League, well-tailored, tan, handsome, unbelievable posture, and he was a candidate they'd never seen before, and he just captivated America. Now, in hindsight, that was a terrible night. You know why?
Why?
Because that's the night that television and politics looked at each other and realized how much they needed each other. And we got married. And they married us for love, and we married them for money. And we ruined... You know, there used to be a time when, you know, there were whistle stops and bunting and bumper stickers and campaign buttons and a small-town parade. All that's gone. It's all television. And you can't... You can't run for office in this country unless you've got the money to buy television time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a terrible state of affairs, because what you've got is the number one qualification to run for office in the greatest democracy on earth is not an ability to govern. It's an ability to raise money, and it's only to raise money for television commercials. And if I were king, which I'm not, I'd outlaw them. I would outlaw them. If we're so concerned about the health of America that we don't run cigarette commercials, I think we're doing as much damage to the health of America with political commercials.
Of course, the candidates would claim, and I'm no fan of politicians, as people who listen to this show know. I don't do politics. I don't invite politicians on as guests of this show. But they would claim, well, we have to have free access to the airwaves. How can you ban us from talking directly to the people?
First of all, that whole airwaves bit is baloney. Most of it's on cable, which people pay for. Nobody's using the airwaves. But there are constitutional scholars who will tell you that it is a violation of the First Amendment to deny a politician buying as much television time as he can afford to buy. I think the Founding Fathers would turn over in their graves if they knew that was the justification for what's happened to politics in America, that it's become one big money game.
When you were sitting in that control room in 1960, producing and directing the debate between Nixon and Kennedy, did you feel like you were involved in something special, aside from it being the first time this had ever happened?
Yeah, I really did.
You knew?
Yeah, you know what I thought? That's funny. I thought, oh my God, we don't have to wait for election night. That we're electing a president right here on television, and there's something wrong with that. You know, it's okay to pick Miss America by who looks the best, but you don't want to pick your president by who looks the best. I think we probably got the right guy for the wrong reason.
Through the years, you've done lots of stuff with different presidents. You actually had a kind of relationship with LBJ there for a while.
Right.
What was he like?
Scary.
Why?
Well, he was big and tough, and, you know, he looked like he was a character in a Western. And you don't want to mess with him. I He was not my favorite of all the presidents.
Who was your favorite?
Harry Truman.
Why?
I know. He was down to earth. First of all, he did the two bravest things any president has ever done. He fired MacArthur, which is a pretty brave thing to do. And two, he let the Dixiecrats walk out of the Democratic Convention in 1948 in Philadelphia. And I was there when they walked out. And he as much as said, so long, pal, get, we don't need you.
Mm-hmm.
It took an awful lot of guts to let the Dixiecrats walk out and to fire Douglas MacArthur. I don't know if anybody else was had the guts to do that.
When you're doing a show with a politician, a presidential candidate or somebody who was even holding that office at the time you're going to talk to them, and Mike Wallace is going to go in and talk to them, or Harry Reasoner in the early days, or Morley
right.
Safer now, or whoever it turns out to be,
right.
Is there any of that, I have to come up with something to get this guy with?
No, you know, there's too much of that in journalism now. You know, what are we going to get him with? How are we going to get him? Let me go back for a second about journalists in general. I think sometimes we're too big for our britches. And I think that the question that's frequently asked of journalists, who died and left you in charge, is not necessarily an invalid one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes you do get a little too big for your britches, and then you gotta walk around and say, hey, fellas, down, boy.
It's ironic to hear you say that because 60 Minutes has a reputation as being the gotcha show.
Yeah, we did a lot of that, but it got to be a cliche because so many other people were doing it and doing it badly. And, we did. I guess we unearthed so many crooks that we kind of got labeled as the gotcha show. But my favorite line, we were once in Philadelphia, Morley Safer and I, speaking to a group, and a guy got up and he said, why does someone who was obviously a crook, decided to go on 60 Minutes, and Morley had the perfect answer. He said, a crook doesn't believe he's made it as a crook until he's been on 60 Minutes.
That is exactly right. Have any of your crew ever been attacked by any of these guys?
No, I don't think anybody's ever really had a physical attack. There are all sorts of empty threats, but nobody takes them very seriously.
Mm-hmm. You were also one of the first shows, I guess, to do hidden camera journalism, which now is de rigueur on Dateline in 2020. And
yeah,
Prime
they
Time
run
and
into the ground.
Stuff. Yeah, you don't do that anymore, do you?
No, I once went down to help ABC on they did a Nightline after they'd done the hidden camera in a supermarket chain, and I said, you know, I think you guys are drunk on hidden cameras. I think you were probably sober the day you put the camera in this supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're running it into the ground. You should use them few and far between. We used it too much.
Did any of you or they, cross an ethical line with them, do you think?
No, but you do cross ethical lines. I'll tell you a perfect one. We once went into a phony cancer clinic where they were taking old people left and right on a phony cancer cure. Did we lie to get in there? Yes. Did we cheat on it and claim we were following all the procedures they gave us when we weren't? Yes. Would I do it again? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once a print journalist, who I'm very fond of, and in a discussion said, you know, you've got no right to use these hidden cameras and show people in the act of committing a crime until they've been indicted or taken before a jury or booked or something. And I said, wait a minute. Have you ever run a picture in your newspaper of one of those bank cameras showing a guy holding up a bank? They said, yeah, what about it? I said, did you have any right to show him holding up the bank? He wasn't indicted for anything. So, you know, there's a double standard. Newspaper men versus television.
Paul Harris talking with Don Hewitt, the executive producer of 60 Minutes for, is it 32 years you've been on that, Don? 33 years.
22 in the top 10, which I always claim is pretty good because Lucy only had 12.
And what's your relationship with CBS management and ownership like these days?
Good.
Yeah?
Sure. Listen, these guys are in business. Just like every radio station in America. They're in business.
Mm-hmm.
And they sell commercials. And I got no problem with people in business. You know, the great New York Times, they pride themselves on two things. They say, we cover news better than anyone in the world, and we sell advertising better than anyone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't fault them on either one.
But you haven't always had that great relationship with management, have you?
Well, you know, we've had some problems along the way, but that's inevitable. I guess it's happened in every business.
Were there owners that you didn't like along the way, too? Because I know CBS has gone through a few ownership changes.
I've had some differences of opinion with some of the people at work here who ran this place.
Differences of opinion? Don, you once threatened to buy it out from under them.
Yeah, well, you know, I figured they're selling off half the company. If they're going to sell the news division, sell it to us.
Who was us?
Mike Wallace, Morley Safer, Dan Rather, Bill Moyers, Diane Sawyer, and me.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to buy it out from under them and turn it into what?
I figured that if they were going to sell the news division, they were selling everything in those days. They sold the record division, they sold the book division, they sold the magazine division. And I figured, wow, if these guys are about to sell the news division, let's just buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'd have to go out and find the capital. But that wouldn't have been tough.
And would you still have been able to put it on CBS broadcast television?
I think we put it out as a service to anybody who wanted it.
Dan Rather was interviewed recently about possibly merging CBS News and CNN, and he says he doesn't think it would be such a bad idea. What about you?
Well, I go even further than that. I think it's time that they pooled the evening newscasts of the three networks because you can't go on spending that kind of money and covering the world properly. But if the three networks got together at 6:30 every night and pooled one big newscast that Rather, Jennings, and Brokaw were all on in one way or another, out in the field or back here, and they could then reopen all these foreign bureaus they've closed, it would be a blockbuster. If you take the ratings of the three broadcasts a day and put them together, something like, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or The Survivor,
mm-hmm.
the same type of numbers,
mm-hmm.
it would be big and important, and people keep saying, yeah, but you take the competition out of it, and I keep saying competition is not what drives people to be good. Competition makes people bad. In television, it's the competition that causes broadcast to be lousy when they could be good, because they're vying for the lowest common denominator. And I'd like to start looking for the highest common denominator.
So you think when there's a lot of competition, people think, oh, yeah, well, we'll put strippers on because that'll definitely draw
you
viewers.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah. CBS is not in the cable news business, never has been. The other networks.
Big mistake. Big mistake. Do you know that ESPN, that's owned by ABC, makes more money than ABC?
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible that these cable networks are making a fortune. And CBS was asleep at the switch when it happened.
So a merger between CBS and CNN of their news-gathering resources or something like that wouldn't necessarily be such a bad idea.
Not a bad idea at all. I'd just like to go further than that. I'd like to just do the evening news as a big pool. You know, people say, you can't pool. I said, of course you can pool it. We pool presidential debates. We pool White House news conferences. We pool some of the space shots. Pool the evening news. What's the big deal?
But in a 24-hour news world, is that half hour of news relevant anymore?
Now you got your fingers on it. I think you could make it relevant because you'd have to make it big and important, and it's almost like merging Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News into one big conglomerate that is better than anything else, and you'd get your all news all day long, and then at 6:30 at night, you stop dead, and the best journalists on earth, coming from places on earth you never covered before because you couldn't afford to, would fill you in on what's happening in your world.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Don Hewitt. The book is called Tell Me a Story. What is the story hierarchy on 60 Minutes? Does Mike Wallace get to pick what he wants and then,
nope.
then safer than Bradley?
Everybody does.
Yeah.
They're all good.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm going to have to. You know where I got to run?
Yeah.
I got to go because Peter Jennings is getting an award in a few minutes.
Oh,
the Fred Friendly Award, and I got to be at that lunch because Peter's a close dear friend.
I will let you go then, and
Paul, I'd love this conversation.
I hope we can do it again sometime, Don.
You name it, I'll be there.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don Hewitt, the man behind 60 Minutes for more than three decades. 33 years now, 22 of those in the top 10. I don't think that has ever been accomplished in primetime television by anybody. Carson certainly had a tremendously long run as number one in late night. I don't think anybody's ever done that in primetime before. And I will try to have Mr. Hewitt back on here again, and we will talk some more here on the Big 550 KTRS.